for everyone that's here. Come on, I need one more person to walk in quickly so that I don't have to buy cappuccinos. Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Falk. Great to see so many people here. And tonight does mark the third speaker in our CFR program series that we're doing in partnership with the Council on Foreign Relations. Mel Cusin is not with us tonight, but Mel would be very pleased because Mel is always concerned about the Council's crystal ball to be sure that our programs coincide with world events. And I was talking with him a few hours ago, and he had a good laugh when I reminded him that we would be focusing on Korea this evening. As a former resident of Houston, Texas, I lived on Rice Boulevard. And so, yeah, so it's great to see so many Rice alumni here tonight. Just a wonderful turnout. Let's give Rice. You know, I have to say, as a Virginia graduate, I mean, I guess if you can't be seated number one in the NCAA, you might as well come to the World Affairs Council programs. Quite seriously, Rice alumni, I hope you will take a look at the World Affairs Council and consider becoming a member. Just go to dfwworld.org to learn more. And our membership department even gave you a special promo tonight to join the council, giving you a discount. So I hope you really will look at some of the activities that are happening. And let me just tease you with a few programs that are taking place over the course of the next few weeks and months. Steve Cole, and I know Rice alumni all take the New Yorker, so you are well aware of Steve Cole, who's a New Yorker journalist, wrote the book Ghost Wars, which really led up to 2001. His new book, Directorate S, is the CIA's and America's secret wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Like you, I'm pretty tired of reading about Afghanistan and Pakistan. But I picked up this book now about 10 days ago, and it is phenomenal. It is so well researched. And Lee, you and I have talked about this before. Sometimes the best information you can get is when someone has been out of office for 1.5, 2 years. And Steve has been able to interview some of the key characters that Jim Holifield at the Tower Center and the World Affairs Council have brought to Dallas, from a Mark Grossman to a Ryan Crocker to a General Petraeus. All of these people have talked on the record and off the record with Steve Cole, and so it really is an amazing book to truly understand how we got to where we are and where we may go. And I saw just a headline this morning. I mean, there's discussion about how the Taliban could be brought in to negotiate with Afghanistan and what role the United States might have. So that's this Thursday, March 15th, at Interabang Bookstore, right there by Central Market. Also, we're very pleased to host Emmy winner Jorge Ramos. And we're doing this in partnership with our friends at the Dallas Morning News and Al Día. And that's going to be at the Texas Theater. And how many of you know where the Texas Theater is? Great. Easy to get to. Somebody said, it's so hard to get there. Hey, we have bridges that take you there now. It's not that hard. And after Jorge speaks, we can go over to Mercado 369 for a reception, where there'll be a wonderful reception and a benefit for the World Affairs Council as well there, hosted by our friend George Baldor. And then here's something that our staff doesn't even know about, because I was at home this afternoon waiting for the air conditioner repairman, who showed up late, and that's why Terrell Falk is not here. But we will be doing a program on Sunday, April 8th, in collaboration with Arts and Letters Live. And we'll be working with them. They're the ones who brought in, or will be bringing in, Luis Alberto Urrea. And I read his book years ago at the suggestion of the Consul General of Mexico, The Devil's Highway. And that made me understand the border more than any other book and got me really interested in it. And his new book is House of Broken Angels. So that'll be at Arts and Letters Live. And there you go, staff. You just heard about it. And we'll be promoting that at the World Affairs Council. And then May 31st, Jim Clapper will be our guest. Yeah. So We're going to be having some other big announcements probably for the month of May that if I'm not like President Trump, I don't tease you and then say what I'm teasing you about. I'm going to wait until I know it's definite. So with that, let me ask you to remember to turn on your cell phone when you leave today's event. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce Deborah Fikes, who is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, who also serves on the board of a remarkable organization. Frank Roby is on the board with you, I believe, the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, and she will introduce Lee Cullum and, of course, our guest, Scott Snyder. Thank you so much.
Yes. Well, it's an honor to be here, and in light of the rapidly changing current events on the Korean Peninsula, we are very fortunate to welcome an expert today that will help us better understand one of the biggest issues facing American foreign policy, North Korea's nuclear threat, and the delicate U.S.-Korea relationship, which will culminate in May with the highly anticipated meeting between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, we anticipate. Scott Snyder is a senior fellow for Korea Studies and director of the program on U.S.-Korea policy at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. Prior to joining CFR, he was a senior associate at the Asia Foundation, where he founded and directed the Center for U.S.-Korea Policy and served as the foundation's representative in Korea from 2004 to 2009. His long list of accomplishments include authoring and editing a number of books and chapters on Korean politics and Asian regionalism, and I can highly recommend his newest book. You need to read his book if you're interested in what's happening on the Korean Peninsula. He has advised NGOs and humanitarian organizations operating in North Korea and serves on the advisory councils of the National Committee on North Korea and the Global Resource Services. He earned his master's degree at Harvard and his bachelor's at Rice University. And before I say a few personal words about Scott, I also want to thank our moderator tonight, Lee Cullum. She is my hero, my heroine. I love her. And I always like to try to attend things where I see that she's going to be a part of it. And all of you know who she is, a member and host of CEO on Kira here in Dallas. Finally, I would like to just add some personal notes about Scott. As someone who has been involved with humanitarian organizations that work in North Korea, including U.S. humanitarian workers for several years, as I have been, I can tell you that Scott is highly respected, not only in Washington, D.C. circles, in New York circles, international circles, South Korean circles, but also in North Korean circles. They read what he says and they respect him as an objective commentator. So his work is very valued. He's also one of the most humble and gracious men you could ever work with. And I consider him a trusted advisor, mentor, and dear friend. So please join me in welcoming today Scott Snyder.
Very generous introduction. Scott and I both thank you. And I want to add my congratulations to yours for your book, Scott. It's really riveting and so enlightening in so many ways. So thank you for that. Thank you for being here. I'm just wondering if anybody warned Rex Tillerson to beware the Ides of March, minus 2 days, and what this might mean for this wave of diplomacy that's about to wash over Northeast Asia.
Yeah, well, that's a In a way, a kind of tragic question to start with. Unfortunately, I feel a little bit bad about showing up in Texas on the day that Rex Tillerson is leaving the administration. And of course, we know that President Trump and Secretary Tillerson were not always on the same wavelength especially on North Korea. We saw that the president contradicted Secretary of State on a number of occasions. I think that the newly designated Secretary of State designate, Mike Pompeo, is probably more on the same wavelength with President Trump, taking a little bit of a harder line on North Korean issues and perhaps not trying to lure North Korea to the table as much, but of course, it looks like North Korea may be at the table. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. State Department, I think, has traditionally been the main channel for dealing with North Korea. I wonder whether that is going to continue or whether that responsibility is going to be handled in a different way, and exactly how. I think everybody wants to know how President Trump is going to staff his preparations for a summit with Kim Jong-un.
Well, it's a good question. There is no ambassador to South Korea at the moment. Victor Cha was going to be proposed, but he was withdrawn because he said something that didn't sit well with the White House. There is no assistant secretary for East Asian Affairs. Joseph Yoon, the most experienced negotiator we have, has abruptly resigned or retired. So can Mike Pompeo get a team together in time for the first summit we're expecting in late April?
Well, he's going to have to, I think, in conjunction with the National Security Council. And in a way, the good news is that Mike Pompeo did establish a special office at the CIA that was focusing on North Korean issues. But the job of intelligence gathering and intelligence analysis and the job of policy formulation are different, and so we'll just have to see how that plays out. I personally think that we're going to end up leaning on the South Koreans kind of heavily in terms of helping to try to mediate preparations for any kind of potential summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, and frankly, I'm expecting a lot of volatility, on again, off again. Trump could pull out. Kim Jong-un could pull out. They could pull each other back in. I mean, frankly, I think that both of them are like fishermen who have caught the biggest catch of their lives, but we don't know whether their pole is strong enough to lure in the fish, and so we'll have to wait and see.
That could very well be the case. You know, the New York Times has made much of the fact that we have not really heard from Pyongyang about this meeting in late May between the two heads of state. We've heard from the two envoys from South Korea, the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the peace. So what's going on here? I mean, we don't have anything official. I mean, is Kim Jong-un leaving room to maneuver and perhaps back out? What do you think?
I do think there may be an element of that. I think it was fascinating that the White House let the South Koreans go out onto the lawn in order to make this announcement.
So we
have a little bit of plausible deniability as well.
Yeah.
But so today, I saw the first article from a North Korean outlet that try to explain the reasoning behind North Korea doing this at this time. And the main message was North Korea is coming to the table on the basis of strength, which makes you wonder how vulnerable they feel and whether vulnerability might be the driver for
exactly. I mean, we hear that the sanctions have really bitten. They've been sanctioned. I mean, their fish, their textiles, their coal they can't make money off of. They seem to make money off weapons sold to the Middle East, both chemical and other. I have also read the speculation that they may run out of cash by October. Do you think that's true?
Oh, well, so here's the problem with sanctions and with our sanctions analysis, and that is that so far we have anecdotal evidence that sanctions have begun to bite, but we don't really know what we don't know about North Korea's sources of economic earnings. Because what we know is based on what other countries report. And if we read the New York Times, we know that there's also money from Syria for chemical weapons-related equipment. And we know that they're involved with other kinds of illegal transactions that they don't report. So it means that we think that sanctions are going to begin to bite and that they might run out of money by August, but we haven't taken into account all of the earnings. And so what's really interesting to me is that Kim Jong-un did seem to have the strategic sense of perception that his position was going to be strongest in December. So I think he knows what he's facing, and that's a good thing, because, frankly, December was probably his moment of greatest ability to project strength, and as sanctions begin to kick in, it's really going to be all downhill from there.
Well, there's the question of denuclearization, the big question. He has said yes, that's certainly something he will discuss, but there seem to be different understandings of what this means. I mean, to the White House, I gather it means that he gets rid of his nuclear weapons, dismantles them, says goodbye. To him, I understand it means that the whole peninsula will be denuclearized, and we will leave, our 28,000 troops, however, will leave. Isn't that what he has in mind? The U.S.-South Korean alliance will be over.
So obviously the first thing that we have to do is actually have a bureaucratic process where both sides have representatives that compare notes about what does denuclearization mean. And, you know, we usually think of our president as the closer who comes in and closes a deal after years of negotiations on arms control or whatever. This time it's going to be different. It looks like maybe Trump and Kim can talk about the nature of the relationship and provide direction, but then it's going to be likely that we're going to have years and years of effort to define what denuclearization means. And I think that with regard to Kim Jong-un, the big problem is that he fell back on denuclearization as the behest of his father and grandfather, at the same time that he is following a policy in which he's committed to nuclear development. And so we haven't seen that internal contradiction addressed yet in terms of what North Korea is saying.
There was a piece in the Times today questioning where this meeting of the heads of state might take place, perhaps in Freedom House in the South Korean part of Panmunjom, maybe Beijing where they had the Six Nation talks under George W. Bush, maybe Geneva because Kim Jong-un went to school in Switzerland. He might be at home there. Certainly not Washington, certainly not Moscow. Maybe Stockholm, which handles our consular affairs in North Korea. What do you think?
Well, I'm voting.
What would you suggest?
I'm voting for Panmunjom, and I'm actually voting for the idea that Washington and Seoul should do this together, because we actually don't have we have the same objective of denuclearization. I do believe that South Korea, either under a progressive or a conservative government at this point, faces an existential threat from North Korean nuclear weapons, and so we share that in common. South Korea is more likely to be able to hold North Korea's feet to the fire in terms of an actual negotiation. They can do it in the same language. They can cut through the hard stuff. And we don't really have a team ready to try to do that at this moment.
Well, very, very true. So China, you write about China a lot in your book, and for good reason. There's a scholar at Yale Law School who said that the Chinese are not going to be happy that they are not in the room where it happens when this meeting takes place. And what will they do? Will they try to insinuate themselves into these talks somehow?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because, in a way, Kim Jong-un kind of flipped the script on January 1st. When he made his announcement that he was willing to talk about securing a peaceful environment for the Olympics. And he also talked about his approach to the U.S., who has a bigger button, but he didn't talk about China at all. And I think the reason for that is that ultimately what North Korea wants more than anything else is to be treated by the U.S. as having strategic weight. And the way of doing that is actually a play to draw the U.S. in at the expense of China. Now, that's really problematic because China has strategic interests on the peninsula. They want to make sure that whoever is in leadership on the peninsula is friendly toward China's interests. And so it's going to be very interesting. I think the Chinese are outwardly glad that talks are going to occur, but inwardly worried that the U.S. and DPRK are somehow going to cut a deal that is going to be damaging to Chinese interests.
Or is it possible that if these talks succeed in some way, it might dilute this combination of South Korea, U.S., and Japan, this alliance that China's fed up with and wants to see diluted, if not see it disappear?
You could make that argument. I think the Chinese will certainly make the argument that if peace breaks out on the Korean Peninsula, there's no need for a U.S.-Korea alliance. The U.S. position together with South Korea is actually that we want to see a unified peninsula and an alliance maintained. And so that's really one of the intractable components of addressing this issue. I mean, I like to think about the Korean Peninsula as kind of like a Rubik's Cube. You need to have the peninsular, the regional, and the global components all aligning with each other before you're going to be able to solve this combination and have peace come out on the peninsula. And so these geostrategic kind of roadblocks, especially between the U.S. and China, between Japan and China, are real problems as we look at how you get from here to there.
Well, in the midst of all this, we've had the administration announce tariffs, 25% on imported steel, 10% on imported aluminum. This is really tough for South Korea. We got 10% of our steel there from them. And I was reading today, it doesn't harm China nearly as much. It'll cost them maybe $689 million. Korea, $1.1 billion. Are they not disturbed?
I think South Korea is really the biggest unintended victim of U.S.-China trade tensions. And also, this is a contradiction in our policy towards South Korea right now because, you know, right at the moment when security tensions are at their highest, we have an issue like trade emerging as a fundamental potential obstacle to managing the relationship effectively. And here we were last week where the Trump administration gave exceptions to Mexico and Canada, our NAFTA partners, at the same day that the South Koreans are presenting Trump with the biggest gift imaginable, right? The possibility of a historic meeting with Kim Jong-un. And yet Trump doesn't give the National Security Advisor of South Korea an assurance that they can also get an exception. I can't explain that particular, the way that that has played out.
Well, on the contrary, complains that South Korea sends too many cars and therefore we have a trade deficit, the Kia and the Hyundai, complains that the Chinese are sending steel through South Korean products into the U.S.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think for President Trump, the merchandise trade balance is everything. He's going for fair and reciprocal trade. I just don't happen to share that particular vision for how trade works in the world. And it's putting us at a disadvantage as we try to compete in Asia.
I have a friend who says, oh, it's so horrible, I have a trade deficit with my barber. So that's what we seem to have with South Korea. You know, you write so very interestingly in your book about the conservative and progressive factions in the politics of South Korea. In the 10 presidents since 1948, beginning with Sigmund Rhee, there have been 7 conservatives, 3 progressives. Kim Jae-un, who had the Sunshine Policy, followed by Noh Moo-hyun, for whom the current president worked. Then that subsided, but now we have a progressive back. If Moon Jae-in succeeds in any way at all, will this bring on a progressive realignment, as we say in the U.S., in South Korea?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, I've been wondering, because of the intensity of the division between progressives and conservatives in South Korea, whether they started it and we're learning from them in terms of polarization, or whether you know, we started it and they're learning from us. You know, the divisions are that deep. In South Korea, there are people who should know each other on one side or the other who actually don't know each other because they simply don't associate socially. And so, I mean, that's a source of weakness, I think, within South Korean politics as it manages its foreign policy. It's absolutely true that if Moon Jae-in is successful in opening the way to peace on the Korean Peninsula, conservatives will begrudge him that accomplishment. At the same time, it's important for the current president to pay very close attention to conservative concerns about South Korean security, because those concerns have to be resolved in order to be able to get to his objective of peaceful denuclearization.
Well, Kim Jong-un didn't even take any conservatives with him for that first meeting, Sunshine meeting, I gather.
Yeah, I think that was a huge mistake. I mean, the Sunshine policy that Kim Dae-jung followed back in the late 1990s, you know, it definitely opened the way to the first and second inter-Korean summits, and it really changed the... it was sold as a way of changing North Korea, but it actually turned out to change South Korea because it introduced divisions within South Korea between the progressives and the conservatives that were very deep. And I think that one of the failings of that effort was, in fact, that it ended up being a partisan initiative rather than a bipartisan initiative. And so it's going to be really interesting to see. I mean, frankly, the divisions are just as deep for Moon right now. I don't know if he can get a conservative to join him in outreach to Kim Jong-un. So far, with regard to Kim Jong-un's sister's visit at the opening ceremonies and to the Korean general's visit, who's responsible for inter-Korean relations at the closing ceremonies, I mean, that actually... the visit of the general was a highly divisive issue for Korean conservatives because this is the man who was responsible, reputedly, for sinking a South Korean naval vessel where they lost 46 South Korean sailors and also was reportedly responsible for shelling a South Korean-controlled island near the DMZ. So, I mean, this is these are issues that evoke strong emotion. You can see the North Koreans trying to play with those issues, generate divisions. And really, that's my book is about South Korean foreign policy, but North Korean policy in a nutshell, North Korean policy 101, they look for divisions to try to exploit.
But the real question is the end of divisions on the peninsula. The progressives have always wanted reunification. The conservatives, no, hard line. Security is the concern. And you wrote something that was very interesting to me. You said that South Korea has always been prepared to pay the lion's share of the cost. I didn't understand that. I've talked to people there who say, no, 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 reunification some distant day, but we don't. It's too expensive. I mean, they look at Germany, and they think, I have read, they say that, my word, North Korea is 17 times worse than East Germany was when the wall came down. So what do you see ahead on this front? Could it happen?
If unification were to occur, it would be more expensive, I think, than in Germany. It would be more difficult socially than in Germany. I think that the two Koreas are really almost out of phase. And increasingly what we see is that South Korean young people don't want it because they know how expensive
it was a young person I talked to a year ago.
Yes. And so... really, so the South Koreans within their government, they have this... ministry called the Ministry of Unification. It's focused on North Korea. I personally like to think that they should just change their name to the Ministry of Peaceful Coexistence, because really that is probably the more suitable goal for a South Korean government to pursue. The only problem is that despite all of the efforts that have gone into trying to think about can the Koreans do what Germany did or whatever, in the end, a former South Korean unification minister once told me, well, unification is not something that we can achieve. It is something that will come to us. And that ultimately, I think, is a deep truth that South Korean governments are not going to have control over, and then they're going to have to deal with it.
Through some kind of upheaval?
if there's some kind of destabilization in North Korea, if North Korea actually moves in the direction of South Korea, ultimately, whatever happens with regard to unification, it's going to happen not because of South Korean strategies, but because of North Korean choices to try to move closer to South Korea, to potentially take economic strategies that end up bringing about, and political strategies that bring about failure or destabilization.
Well, if they tried to reunify now, my guess is both Seoul and Pyongyang think that they would be terrific to run the government. There's not going to be any rapprochement that I could. Do you think? After reading your book, I don't see any.
Well, that's been the longstanding.
You know, one will be president, one prime minister, and so forth, Lebanon style.
It's the two Koreas have been competing for on legitimation grounds, legitimacy grounds, for decades. And the progressives actually do want to see this kind of gradual rapprochement. You know, that's part of the idea behind the idea that the right pathway should be peaceful denuclearization that the current government is trying to follow. The current government needs the North Koreans to do denuclearization, and they need the Trump administration to be peaceful. And so they're trying to open up that pathway. So I think there's a very good logic for pursuing that path, but in the end, I think that it's hard to imagine that unification on the Korean Peninsula is going to occur without a clear victory by one or the other.
Well, there are those who say that these talks can't possibly succeed. Many have failed. Many have been tried. Many have failed. Let's go back, as you do in your book, to George H.W. Bush and the Joint Declaration. That was very high-minded.
Well, and I think that was, in a way, a high point. There were several important things that occurred right at the end of the Cold War. One of them was an inter-Korean agreement that basically lays out everything that the two Koreas have to do in order to achieve a gradual unification process. And really, you know, at the same time, at the end of the Cold War, the Bush administration was just beginning to focus on the problems related to North Korea's nuclear ambitions. And they actually succeeded in a high-level meeting at the Undersecretary of State level with the North Korean party counterpart in getting the North Koreans to accept inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And so this was, you know, a moment that had promise, but that it unraveled precisely because of the emergence of the North Korean nuclear issue. This was really right at the beginning. Here we are 25 years later, 26 years later, and we see what the nuclear issue has become. This was the beginning of it. It was the origin. And it actually derailed what at the time was the best prospect for a peaceful pathway toward unification.
Well, it said we will not manufacture, we will not possess, we will not deploy, we will not use, we will have nothing to do with nuclear weapons, neither one of us, on this peninsula.
That's right. And so the other agreement, I was really talking more about the basic agreement structure, but there was another agreement for denuclearization between the two Koreas. That interestingly, the North and South Koreans promised to basically forswear nuclear development. And the North Koreans obviously have departed from that. Interestingly, so far, the South Koreans are actually holding to it by pursuing only a peaceful nuclear power program. The interesting question is really we're at a point where North Korea has conducted like 6 nuclear tests, and South Koreans are looking to the U.S. and saying, well, how's that? Give us some assurance that you're really going to defend Seoul if San Francisco or Los Angeles are threatened. And so I do think the North Koreans have identified the wedge, the point of division, and they're also testing South Korea's commitment to not enrich and to not pursue their own nuclear weapons capability.
Which they did once under Park Chung-hee. I didn't know that until I read your book.
Absolutely. No, that, in a way, is the really interesting, you know, one of the interesting lessons of history is, you know, Park Chung-hee did pursue a covert nuclear program in the 1970s. The United States found out about it and confronted Park. And they basically, in the end, president to president, said, if you keep on pursuing this nuclear program, it's the end of the alliance. But then let's think about North Korea. At least the U.S. had the leverage of an alliance relationship with South Korea to use as a way to curb South Korea's nuclear weapons development. But what leverage do we have with North Korea? Where did we go wrong? Actually, if you go back and dig into the history, the North Koreans issued their own threats to go nuclear when Shevardnadze showed up in Pyongyang in order to tell the North Koreans that the Soviet Union at the time was going to normalize with South Korea. And they said the same thing to the Chinese foreign minister, Chen Shih-chan, in the early 1990s. And so in a way, the problem is that the North Koreans lost their security guarantor and decided to go it alone. And yet, here we are in a situation where who has the leverage?
We thought China did.
Well,
maybe.
So the Chinese think that, we think that the Chinese have all the leverage, and economically they do. The Chinese think that we have all the leverage because we have the political incentives that are on offer.
And the military threat.
Yeah. And so the question is, how do you put all those together? I mean, in a way, this is, I hate to say that this intractable problem is simple, but it's basically a collective action problem. The only issue is that everybody has their own immediate security dilemmas and needs that they put in front of the shared objective of a non-nuclear Korean peninsula. And that prevents the neighbors from fully cooperating.
So the neighbors are not fully cooperating. What else is new? Let's hear from all of you. We have a microphone. All right. Oh, right here.
Considering the size, strength, capability, education of North Korea, where did they get the technology, the engineers, the scientists, to be able to build nuclear weapons, intercontinental ballistic missiles, all by themselves?
Okay. Well, no, I think there was help at various times. I mean, so, you know, the North Korean desire for nuclear weapons, I think initially it was a gleam in the eye of Kim Il-sung at the time of the end of World War II when they saw how powerful the atomic bomb was. And they sent nuclear scientists to the Soviet Union from the 1960s. They probably got a big benefit from the end of the Cold War from former Soviet nuclear engineers who needed a job. And they have been most recently very active in procurement of components from the international community on the open market for their nuclear and missile programs. The scary thing is now that they've gotten the components, they're trying to indigenize. And so that means that they're actually taking what they've learned from the international community and trying to build it themselves in order to, as a buffer, so that the international community actually won't have leverage over them to prevent them from developing the program.
And what about Khan in Pakistan? Oh, excuse me, go ahead.
Forgive me, but you can't go to Amazon and say, I want to order one intercontinental ballistic missile.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to sell them one?
Well, they've already got it at this point. I mean, you know, they're Koreans. So, I mean, in a way, and this is 50-year-old technology, 50-plus-year-old technology. And so, you know, I think they've done their homework. They've gathered everything available on the internet, and believe me, if you're a North Korean scientist, you're highly motivated to become really a top specialist in your subject. And so if the leader says he wants a missile, you're going to do your best to make him satisfied.
Let's go here and then over here. Oh, I'm sorry, you're already over there. We'll reverse it.
Yes, I'm Dick Grote. If I understood you correctly, and I may have missed this, as I recall, you said that you did not anticipate there would be one Korea until one of the two Koreas was victorious over the other. Did I understand you correctly? And how would you see that happening?
The North Koreans in particular, I think, have continued to maintain, as part of their revolutionary ideology, the dream that they would put the two Koreas back together under Pyongyang's leadership. In South Korea, I think that they're ready to move on in a way, but they're the more powerful party. They're the ones that have actually been successful. And so, you know, in the end, there's a possibility slash likelihood that indeed North Koreans are going to look at the South Korean model and say, gosh, well, that's the kind of, we want to be a part of that, right? And so the harder challenge is imagining, even despite the prospect of an inter-Korean summit, that indeed we're going to see this gradual process. I could be wrong, we're all speculating, but the likelihood that there's going to be a gradual negotiated process, well, first of all, it would have to be one that involves subsidies over decades to help the North Koreans raise their economic level in order to help stem refugee flows. Secondly, there would have to be some kind of political convergence between the two sides. We're talking about one of the most, you know, authoritarian nations on earth and a free democracy. How is that going to work? It'll take time, you know, probably generations to try to close those gaps.
Right here, and then back there.
Question concerning North Korea. North Korean defectors often make the point that the most potent weapon against North Korea is information. And I know it's hard to assess, but my question is this: how much real information is getting in? How widespread is it? What is the likelihood that information could, in fact, bring down the regime?
I think there's been progress in that area over the course of the last 2 decades. I mean, really, I would say that it goes back to the famine and marketization in North Korea, because marketization stimulates the most effective method of information sharing and information penetration that exists in North Korea, and that is word of mouth. Secondly, we see from defector testimonies that, in fact, exposure to outside media over the course of the past decade has been on the rise. It's on the increase. And we know that there's a lot of efforts in terms of information penetration strategies, you know, to get DVDs of, you know, frankly, the most successful things are not, political science libraries. They're really South Korean dramas, right, into North Korean hands. The problem is that technology cuts both ways, and the North Korean regime is increasingly using technology to ensure that if you put the USB into the computer, that the USB gets erased, or taping snapshots on desktops as a means of surveillance to catch people who are looking at illicit materials. Or the classic low-tech way of trying to catch people who are watching what they're not supposed to watch, and that is cutting off the power to the apartment complex and then going apartment by apartment to see which CDs or DVDs got stuck in the machines, and then punishing the individuals who had possession of that material.
This is a question building on basically the same information. What have you seen, or what has been the reaction to the impact of the most deepest penetration recently, which was the Olympics? We've heard that a lot of the athletes are having to go through re-education because of the exposure to South Korea. Are you seeing anything any impact on the basis of what everybody saw in the Olympics, and will there be a pushback on that?
It's really too early to be able to make that kind of assessment, but I have a little bit of an unorthodox view about the impact of the Olympics on North Korea, because the Olympics was not shown on North Korean TV. And the individuals who went to the Olympics were carefully selected, and so they were members of the elites. And so, frankly, participation in the cheering squad was a reward for North Korean elite families to have somebody who went to South Korea. And the athletes are elites. The high-level officials are elites. Everybody who went to South Korea from North Korea, I mean, let's face it, in the end, if you're a member of the North Korean elite, you're actually a voyeur on the world. You can see the world, you know what's out there, you just can't participate. And all you know is that if you move to South Korea, your status will not be as high in South Korean society. So are you going to hang together or are you going to hang separately? Well, you're going to hang together and you're going to try to expand your enjoyment, bring what you can to North Korea in terms of creature comforts. And in a way, the real question is whether Kim Jong-un is, in the end, going to be eaten alive by the revolution of rising expectations.
Yes, right here.
She's the one. Go ahead.
Thank you. I was in South Korea last week, and I had a chance to hear from Minister of Unification right after the news came out about the potential talk between South and North Korea. And he said something very, very interesting in the meeting, say that we need to focus on the timing, the why Moon Jae-in administration tried to have this summit in early on in his administration, in his presidency. Past two summits between South and North Korea, both by the progressive government, Kim Dae-jung administration, right after they had the summit, something has changed in United States. United States had a new government coming in with totally different set of strategy toward North Korea. And then Nam Hoo-yeon, he also had a summit very end of his presidency. And then President Lee Myung-bak, the new administration in South Korea, came in with a totally different strategy toward North Korea. So President Moon Jae-in, who was chief of staff for Nam Hoo-yeon, who worked behind the scene for the summit between Nam Hoo-yeon and Kim Jong-il, learned the hard lesson and wanted to have this early on his presidency so they have enough time to deliver what has agreed between North and South. So what I'm interested in hearing your perspective on this, and also how can, if this is right, then how can South Korea make sure that U.S. policy will be consistent throughout the Trump administration as well as after Trump administration?
That's asking a lot.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, in a way, the really interesting question, you know, President Moon has been in office for less than a year, and really over the course of the past 3 months, you know, everything has changed, and somehow he's way ahead of schedule over the course of the last 3 months. So, you know, it might be good to have an early summit, but I don't think that the South Koreans were actually planning on having it that early. And so it raises the question of why the urgency on the North Korean side. You know, North Korea, Kim Jong-un has been driving this since January. And so we've got to ask, well, what is the reason? And I'm not sure that that has completely unfolded yet. And it looks like Kim Jong-un has a sense of urgency both about meeting Moon and about meeting Trump. I mean, from my perspective, on the one hand, you know, this is great because we're talking about Kim Jong-un, a leader who, you know, until last week, in his social media circle, or social circle, there was only one person who knew Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, and it was Dennis Rodman, right? And so suddenly, you know, the number of channels of communication potentially between Kim and Trump has tripled. I mean, this is great because the South Korean National Security Advisor might actually know how to use it in order to achieve some kind of positive result. But, I mean, the really interesting question, I just want to focus in on this, is what's motivating Kim Jong-un? And I don't, we're going to be speculating a lot about that. Nobody can say for sure. I think it's a combination of sanctions are biting, and it's going to get worse. Frankly, rhetoric. I think rhetoric has had an impact because it's challenged North Korean assumptions about what they could expect from the United States. They've been conditioned to think that they could get away with it because the U.S. would never be willing to pay a higher price, that we were going to give in. And now they've got this president who is putting everything on the table, right? And thirdly, and in a way this is the most interesting one, Kim Jong-un somehow has strategic situational awareness. He knew when to stop, right? Because here he is, November 28th, they launched this big ICBM. Then early December, they declare that they've completed their mission. Okay, well, they haven't completed their mission. Okay, they haven't established a reentry vehicle. They haven't proven that they can strike the United States. Any good negotiator would want all of that leverage. They would want to be able to have, you know, the U.S., you know, as a potential target and be able to use the credibility of the threat as a source of leverage to get more. And so what's really impressive to me about the current situation suddenly is that we have evidence that Kim Jong-un recognizes what's happening in the world. Previously, it was all domestically driven. And now we're right at a moment where it seems like Kim is realizing, oops, maybe I've stepped too far. How am I going to get myself out of this? And so as a result, he's tacking back. He's coming, recognizing he's got to deal with the international community. And from that perspective, it's good for us because now we can communicate concerns and we can indicate where the lines are in a much more effective way than we could have envisioned in December of 2017.
Scott, for some real historical perspective from your book, you said that the South Koreans were really missed the boat back in the 1600s. They didn't disengage from the failing Ming Dynasty and move over to the Qing Dynasty with the Manchu, and then they suffered a lot as a result. What happened?
Yeah, so that's a great question because we always end up focusing on the urgent threat, but then there's this longer-term threat of what is going to happen to Korea in the context of this potential transition in power and influence between the United States and China. And this is a very active strand in South Korea's foreign policy debate. It has a direct impact on how South Korea thinks longer term about Washington and Beijing. They don't want to make the wrong strategic choice and hold on to Washington if they think that Beijing is actually going to be predominant. At the same time, they can't choose Beijing prematurely and then discover that Beijing can't deliver.
And moreover, Beijing's with the North.
Yes, but in the end, I think that, so in a way, the really peculiar thing is that the right strategy for China, as analyzed by some of their foremost security analysts, is to replace the North Korea buffer with a unified Korea buffer. And that means developing a good relationship with South Korea. But over the course of the past year, with this missile defense system, they've been more intent on trying to draw lines and teach South Korea lessons about reliance on the United States than they have been about enticing and wooing South Korea over to their side. And I just think that that, I mean, frankly, it just doesn't make any sense as a Chinese foreign policy strategy because they are ignoring their interest and need to really have the peninsula on their side longer term.
Well, you know, South Korea is in a difficult spot. It reminds me of Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. There's a question in there where he asks, what is the victory of a cat on a hot tin roof? Maggie the cat responds to stay on just as long as she can. That seems to be the spot South Korea is in. Jim, do you want to say goodbye? Scott, thanks to you.
Thank you, Lee. I'm going to use that in my talk.
Thank you.
What a wonderful exchange, and again, what perfect timing. Lee, we have a gift certificate from one of your favorite restaurants that is in the mail.
Lovely.
Or in my car. And Scott, thank you so much. Please tell your friends, Irene and everyone at the council, how much we value this partnership. And you can go to the Council on Foreign Relations website, cfr.org, to follow Scott's work on his blogging. And our friends from Interabang are here, and I hope that you will do us the honor, and Scott, by helping his book continue to rise on all the bestseller lists. And so, and you'll stay around and sign. And we have dinner where, Alana? At the club room.
Thank you so much. Hey.
Thank you.